Hello, Reagan here. Welcome to episode 18 of the Twisted States podcast, where we take a look state by state at some of America's most nefarious killers, elusive cryptids, and bizarre mysteries. Today we're taking a trip down south to Texarkana, Texas, a town located on the border of Arkansas and Texas. The year was 1946. Texarkana was a community of less than 30,000 people. Still a little rowdy and rough around the edges, but for the most part, it's your typical kind of sleepy town. I mean, it was still a time of, you know, leaving your door unlocked and whatever, but at the same time, there were, you know, brawls down at the bowling alley and such, you know. A pretty typical little town, nothing too crazy. But all of that would soon change. On February 22nd, Jimmy Hollis, 25, and Mary Jean Leary, 19, made a little pit stop on their way to their respective homes for the night to an area of town known to be utilized by young couples looking for a little privacy, a lover's lane. Practice it was kind of predating our modern, you know, Netflix and chill. It was common for couples to go and park at the edge of town and get some smooching in before they headed in for the night. About 10 minutes after they parked, a stranger wearing a pillowcase like mask over his head with eye holes cut out approached the car. In the dark, the couple first assumed someone approaching their car with a flashlight would be law enforcement. But upon seeing the mask, they shifted the thoughts to maybe a prankster. Jimmy told him he must have mistaken him for someone else. And then the masked man produced a gun, ordered them both out of the vehicle. After demanding Jimmy remove his trousers, he struck him in the head with his gun so hard that he fractured his skull, and Mary Jean thought he had shot Jimmy. He then told Mary Jean to run, and she did. He then chased her down and assaulted her. Apparently spooked by passing headlights, he fled. So Mary Jean ran for help. They were parked just a few hundred yards from a neighborhood, so she was able to go to a house and get assistance. Luckily, they both survived this attack, with Jimmy spending some time in a coma, but eventually healing from his wounds, and Mary Jean only having minor injuries, not requiring a hospital stay. Minor physical injuries, I'm sure psychologically this got to both of them for quite some time. Once both of them were questioned, Mary Jean described a light-complected black man, but Jimmy described a darker-complected white man. So, who knows, you know, whatever. Either way, he was wearing a mask, so it was really hard to tell exactly what he looked like. No suspect was ever found, and no usable evidence was collected from the scene. Things were just muddled up. Local law enforcement really wasn't up to deal with this kind of stuff. And then they both survived. It was an assault, whatever. So it wasn't really taken as seriously as it probably should have been. The community didn't really react. They just figured that some random couple was assaulted on Lover's Lane. Everybody assumed it was some kind of personal issue, revenge, jealousy, something like that. They just kind of let it go. It didn't really affect people much. They didn't really understand the gravity of the situation just yet. But on March 24th of 1946, all of that would change. Richard L. Griffin, 29, and Polly Ann Moore, 17, were discovered by a car passing by, assumed to be sleeping. The couple were inside their vehicle, parked on the side of the road, and this car came up, and the driver of the car stopped and thought maybe they were broke down and needed some kind of help or whatever, so he stopped, and upon closer inspection, it was obvious that they were not sleeping, they were, in fact, had been murdered. Richard was on his knees in the front seat, and Polly was face down in the back seat. Both had been shot in the head with a .32 caliber gun. Large amounts of blood outside the vehicle indicated that they may have been shot outside the vehicle and placed back inside. With a second attack and actual lives lost this time, the community was struck with the possibility of a serial killer, one that was targeting young lovers out on Lover's Lane. We're parked around the community in different remote areas, getting a little alone time. Of course, you know, hysteria hit. Everybody was flown into a panic. Women were scared to stay home with their kids while their husbands were at work. They were taking their children and checking into hotels. People were calling in tips for everything. Everyone was a killer, you know. Everyone was a suspect, you know, trust no one. And it was a lot, but it wasn't anything useful. It was just people being hysterical. So because of that, they didn't get anywhere, you know, it didn't help the situation. So a little bit more time went by and people were just, you know, there was so much misinformation going around, so many rumors and, you know, and people freak out when things like this happen. And, you know, I mean, rightfully so, but yeah, it was pretty bad. And then the way that both crime scenes were handled weren't the best because, you know, law enforcement at that time in that region, they didn't really have what they needed to handle these types of cases, you know. Didn't have the know-how and training and stuff to know how to like properly collect evidence and not disturb the crime scene in such a way that would, you know, keep them from getting like shoe prints and fingerprints and things of that nature. So kind of a mess. And then on April 14th of 1946, Betty Jo Booker, 15, and Paul Martin, 16, once again, at the end of their evening, went and found a little spot to go pull over and park, hang out, you know, get a little alone time before they headed home. And Paul was found lying partially in the road. He had been shot 4 times, and Betty Jo had been assaulted and shot twice. Both had been shot with a .32 caliber Colt. So now we've got four deceased victims. We've got 2 victims that were lucky to get away with their lives. And full-on panic happening at this point. The local newspapers deemed him the Phantom Killer. And once again, all this information came in, but none of it was actually relevant to the case. People were just speculating and throwing everybody under the bus that they, you know, that they could, I guess. So not even a month following that, on May 3rd, one 37-year-old Virgil Starks was sitting in his living room watching TV when a series of bullets came in through the window and he was shot in the back of the head and died while sitting in his recliner. His wife, Katie, heard the commotion from the bedroom and came running down to find out what was going on. And when she entered the room, she was shot twice in the face. She did not see her attacker. She knew that it came from the window. And she immediately ran out the door and ran to a neighbor's house to get help. It was later found that she had one bullet that hit her in the face passed straight through, and the second one was actually lodged under her tongue. She was able to survive her attack, but unfortunately her husband did not. They were shot with a .22 caliber weapon, and there was no real tie to the other murders. But for some reason, law enforcement felt like this should be considered related. So as a victim, he was lumped in with the other victims. But I don't know. I mean, it kind of sounds like maybe not. This also happened in Arkansas on the other side of the state line, where everyone else that was attacked on, you know, while parking on various outskirts areas of the town, they were all on the Texas side. So who knows? But like I said, it did get kind of lumped in for whatever reason. So even though this case still remains unsolved to this day, there were a couple of suspects that were brought up One of the suspects was H.B. Duty Tennyson. He wasn't really a suspect. I guess we should clear that up from the beginning here. He was never someone that was considered a person of interest. They hadn't questioned him. He had no known involvement of anything around any of these murders or attacks. And strangely enough, he did seem to have a lot of connection to loose connections to all the victims. But at that time, with the community that size, most of the people there would have had some kind of connection to most of the victims, I would think, honestly. Unless they were strictly just like passing through or whatever. A lot of people that lived there in that community probably would have had ties. But Duty wrote out a confession, and that was part of what was included in his suicide note. But like I said, with no other evidence and no other real understanding of why or how he would be connected to and have committed these crimes, that really didn't mean much. Desperate writings of a desperate man. It's not uncommon for people to confess to things that they didn't do. Unfortunately, which is really strange. So who knows? Another person of interest that actually was a person of interest was 29-year-old Yul Lee Swinney. He was a car thief. On June 28, 1946, his wife Peggy, 21, was picked up in a case involving a stolen vehicle. And when they told her, they kind of lied to her and told her that they were holding her husband for murder, that he was suspected of murder. She started just singing like a little bird. But her story kept changing and kept getting weirder and weirder. There were a couple things that she did talk about, like something about Paul and Betty Jo's case. Paul's date book was thrown into the bushes, and she knew about that, but she could have easily witnessed the killing, or she could have very much possibly been involved. Who knows? We'll never know. So that was kind of a weird thing that she had, a detail from one of the murders that wasn't public knowledge or whatever. But none of the rest of her story could really be corroborated. She just kind of was running her head, and her and her husband had a pretty rocky relationship, it seems, and it was just kind of a mess. Yul, on the other hand, he had been caught several times stealing cars and committing other crimes and robberies and things like that. He eventually was kept. They arrested him and held him over because of being a habitual criminal. And he ended up being in prison until 1973. So maybe he was the guy. Maybe not. Who knows? Once again, he never admitted to or confessed to any of those crimes, and there wasn't any, once again, actual evidence tying him directly to them. There was only that one little tenuous piece of information that his wife had mentioned something that hadn't been spoken of publicly about that notebook. But there you have it. This was a story of that inspired a movie, The Town That Dreaded Sundown. If you have or haven't seen it, I want to say I recommend it. It's kind of one of those things. It's like, it's so bad, it's good. I've watched it a few times. It's one of those Halloween staples. But every year I watch it, I'm like, wow. It's sometimes it's a little hard to get through. It's fun to make fun of, I guess. It's kind of a wild movie. It's funny to watch stuff like that and then go back years later and try to watch it again. I haven't seen that movie, hadn't seen it in several years, and then I recently sat down and watched it and just shook my head the whole time. Definitely interesting. That was the 1976. I believe it was released. I think it was. I know the preview came out in 76, but I think the movie was actually released in 77. I'm not sure. It was either 76 or 77. There was also another movie that came out in, I believe, 2014. I haven't seen that since it came out, but I have seen both movies. Anyway, if you want to check those out, like I said, they take a lot of liberty with the stories. And I'll leave some links. If you're watching this on YouTube, there'll be links in the description to some a little bit more reputable sources. And just some other sources that I found when I was looking up this this whole situation here. Things really vary depending on, I mean, there's all kinds of random details thrown in and stuff that does and doesn't make sense. And I don't know, it's kind of wild. It was a little bit weird. I think that's why it took me so long, because I know, like, it's a commonly known story. It's a lot of people know about these murders and whatever. It's a case that's familiar to a lot of people, but there's like all kinds of weird details that are out there, and it's kind of hard to tell like what's a liberty and what's real and what, you know, somebody just kind of filled in the whatever with. So it's a little bizarre to research. Anyway, but there you have it. I hope you have a wonderful week, and Halloween's coming up soon. Yay, I'm so excited. And if you get a chance, hop on over to my YouTube channel, Disruptive Girl. I just recently uploaded a video, including some footage from our haunted ghost train ride up in Ely, Nevada, which was absolutely amazing. I had so much fun. It was really cool. I'm really glad I made the drive. Next time I'm spending the night up there, though, because I made it a day trip, and it's like 260 something miles from my house to there. Yeah, it was a drive. I made it. But in the future, I will spend the night up there, not just deadhead it straight through like that, because wow, that was crazy. Anyway, I'm gonna go, but thank you for joining me, and thank you for everything, and I will see you next time. Bye.